holiness is in right action and courage on behalf of those who cannot defend themselves.
What could a king ask of a man like me?
A better world than has ever been seen. Did you think that lay at the end of Crusade?
Just a bit of the trailer from the new movie Kingdom of Heaven. Historical fiction based upon a period of time we know as the Crusades. We're going to be talking about the Crusades and this movie Kingdom of Heaven with Dr. Thomas Madden, professor and chairman of the Department of History at St. Louis University. Our conversation during this 25 minutes of the program will deal with the movie, but also as historical fiction, how historical is it? Does it paint an accurate picture of the Crusades? If so, good. If not, how should we rightly understand that period of Christian history? Dr. Madden has authored the book, The New Concise History of the Crusades. Dr. Madden, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Doug. Nice to be there.
Well, first of all, tell us about the movie, your impressions of this movie, Kingdom of Heaven.
Well, I'm not a film critic, but overall as a movie, I found it to be a little boring. It's mainly, if you like watching medieval warfare, and if you like seeing people get arrows in the neck and other types of very bloody wounds, then you'll probably like this movie. It's basically a long medieval battle scene stitched together with a kind of a light plot that is not very medieval at all, I'm afraid.
Does it accurately depict the period of history that we know of as the Crusades, the events that surround this?
No.
The events of the Crusades?
No. I think where it's reasonably accurate is in its depiction of weapons and armor and some siege machinery. And it's clear that that's where the writer and the producer were most interested in getting it right. But as far as the actual events, it's not very correct at all. In fact, it's really largely just a work of fiction weaved around some of a few characters that existed at that time.
So,
it's set in the years 1186 and 1187, which is the period of Saladin, just in the years right before Saladin conquered Jerusalem from the Christians and then also subsequently conquered most of the Crusader states.
All right. What does the movie, I want to get into the actual Crusades in a moment, but what does the movie depict as the motivation for the Crusades, for these efforts, these military efforts during this time?
You know, it's odd. There's no real Crusade in this movie. There's just kind of there's the Crusader states, and then there are some people who identify themselves roughly as Crusaders because they have crosses that they wear. But that's about it. There's no major crusade. And that's true. There was no major crusade at this time. But the problem with the movie is this, as you say, the motivation. The motivation for crusaders, for anyone who took the cross and went to the Holy Land, which was extremely expensive and very, very dangerous, were almost entirely pious motivations. And there's almost no piety in this movie. In fact, the odd thing about it is that all of the good guys, for example, Balian or his father Godfrey, or the Hospitaller, or any of them, they're either agnostic, or they are openly hostile to religion, which then of course leads to the question as to why they're crusaders in the first place and why they're going so far from home to fight these deadly battles. Which is a question that's never really answered in the movie. The only religious people in the movie, people like the Templars or Guy Lusignan or Renald of Châtillon, in the movie, these are fairly religious characters and they have piety, but they're all the bad guys. And there are no religious people in this movie who are not fanatics. They're all basically zealots whose religion leads them to want to kill. And that's true also on the Muslim side.
Okay, so paint an accurate picture, in contrast to what the movie paints, what you just described. paint an accurate picture of the motive behind the Crusades for the person who underwent what they considered at the time not only a military endeavor, but essentially a pilgrimage.
Right. It's the above all, the reason that people went on crusade was for pious motivations. What they got out of it was a penitential act. It was seen as an armed pilgrimage, but it was also an act of charity and love. It was viewed that way as a way of going to restore lands that had been taken from Christians back to Christian control. In other words, all of the lands that the Crusades were to were lands that had been Christian, that had been conquered by Muslims. So a crusader underwent enormous expense and put themselves in enormous physical danger because what they got out of it in the end, the biggest thing they got out of it, was penance. In other words, a way of achieving salvation, a way of getting into heaven. And these were warriors who were intensely aware of the fact that their whole lifestyle was one that could easily lead them to earn eternal damnation. So the crusade provided a way for them to use the skill that they had, warfare, for the work of God. And that's the only way that it's really possible to understand the crusades in the Middle Ages. Otherwise, they don't make any sense. Financially, they were a complete mess. No one made money on the Crusades. There just wasn't enough booty around. And the little bit of booty that Crusaders got, they more than spent on the way. The casualty rates were enormous, something like 50% never returned. It can really only be understood in its medieval context, was one in which people cared deeply about the next world and how to ensure that they won salvation in that next world.
So go more deeply into that, if you would, because this is what intrigues me more than the Crusades themselves, and that is the sensibilities of the medieval mind, where events like the Crusades, for good or for ill, were made possible, not only by geopolitical realities, but by the way people thought and believed. Explain
right.
that in more detail.
Well, as I said, the average person, particularly a knight, someone who is of noble class, but the knight whose job it is to wage war, was intensely aware of their own sinfulness. They would learn about this from the local monasteries or local preachers, who would make it clear to them that killing people was not a good thing, and that you would be punished for that. And that's why, for example, in the Middle Ages, you have enormous relationships between noble families and monasteries. That's because these families are trying to use the gains that they've achieved by warfare in pious ways, and by giving those lands to monasteries and by supporting these people who pray, they're hoping, therefore, to have these be treated as penitential acts that will help them to get into heaven. The Crusade was much the same thing. It was a pilgrimage. Pilgrimages were already penitential acts, but it was also this act of charity to help. What you're doing is you're helping your neighbor. It's supposed to demonstrate love of neighbor. These are Christians who you don't know, you've never met. They live thousands of miles away, but you are going to do this righteous act for their benefit and for the benefit of Christ.
Folks, if you saw the movie Kingdom of Heaven, give us a call in the next 15 minutes. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What struck you most about this movie, whose subject, at least as a backdrop, is the Crusades? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Thomas Madden of St. Louis University is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Now, you mentioned that the period of time covered in this movie has no formal crusade in it. Can you give us, if you would, pull the camera back and give us a thumbnail sketch of the whole period of time that we talk about when we talk about the Christian Crusades? It's obviously not constant, unremitting warfare for all those years. How long did this period last, and what was it made up of?
Well, I mean, the traditional Crusades, the Crusades to the Middle East, go from 1095, the calling of the First Crusade, until 1291, which is the fall of the last Crusader Acre in 1291. So that's the traditional Crusades are within there. However, there are numerous Crusades that continue after 1291 and really will continue well into the 16th century. So this movie, though, is set at what's usually considered to be kind of a high point of the Crusades, when people talk about the Crusades, they often will talk about Saladin and then the period immediately after this where you have Richard the Lionheart and the like who are fighting in the Middle East. The movie, therefore, is one of the interesting things about this, and as you say, this was not unremitting warfare. The Crusader states were, most of their history was one of peace with their Muslim neighbors. And one of the angles on this movie is they're trying to set up, it's kind of ironically, they're trying to set up the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, the Crusader state, as a kind of, as they call it, a new world and a kingdom of conscience, a place where Muslims, Christians, and Jews live together in harmony. And this is, it is true that Muslims, Christians, and Jews did live together there in the Crusader Kingdom, but they also lived plenty of other places together peacefully, not just there. There was nothing special in that respect about the Crusader Kingdom.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Ben calls from his car. Ben, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. Hey, I saw the movie, and I got a feeling, and I'd kind of like to ask this for our guests, is was it portrayed as a real, the Muslims were in a positive light, and the Christians, I never...
Ben, thank you for the question. How were Christians and Muslims portrayed respectively in this film?
I think it was largely even-handed. Muslims were portrayed in a fairly good light, although there was one bad Muslim who was, again, the only really religious Muslim that was depicted, a Muslim cleric. And on the Christian side, for the most part, at least those people who didn't take Christianity very seriously, those people were portrayed in a fairly positive light. Those who did, who were religious, were very much in a negative light. So I think in that respect, from a Hollywood perspective, in any case, it was fairly even-handed, I think.
So really, it does, in a way, kind of turn the real historic account of the Crusades on its head. That is, you have noted that the motivations, at least on the face of it, the motivations of those who crusaded were largely pious, whereas the movie seems to depict, well, the religious people are really the true wrongdoers here. They act from impious motivations, whereas the agnostics, the people who don't take Christianity very seriously, they're the ones with the noble motives of creating a state of peace.
Right, and what's interesting about that is that's a completely unmedieval perspective. Those types of people didn't exist in the Middle Ages. The good guys in this are very much modern men. They're people that come from a post-Enlightenment world, not people from a medieval world. Also, you can't help but be struck just by watching this movie how sterilized both Christianity and Islam are. There are no Christians, for example, in the movie who ever pray. You never see anyone pray, something that they did all the time. There's virtually no religious artwork, which would have been everywhere in this time. There are a few crosses here and there, but no crucifixes, which would have been the dominant way of having artistic crosses at that time. There are no icons, no mention of saints or the Virgin, which would have been ubiquitous at that time. There are not even any churches depicted at all in the movie. There are no monks, there's no nuns, there's nothing that you would have seen everywhere, particularly in the holiest city in the world, Jerusalem. And the same is true on the Muslim side. You see some Muslims praying off in the distance. At least they do appear to pray. But that's about it. Besides that, it's an extremely sterilized version. In fact, you really get the feeling watching this movie that Islam and Christianity are just basically the same religion. They just speak different languages.
Sitting on different sides of a border, an arbitrary border.
Yes, that's right.
Were the real contrasts between these two world religions, Christianity and Islam, understood by the Crusaders? Did the Christian Crusaders know what Islam taught, what it was, and did the Muslims understand what Christianity was as a religion?
Not very much. They both sides didn't have, at least in the Crusader states, both sides didn't have much interest in the other's religions. From the Muslim point of view, the Christians were just infidels, and that was all you needed to know about them. Why they were there, what their religious views were, what their motivations were absolutely irrelevant. From the Christian point of view, they, at least in the Crusader states, they didn't have much understanding of what Islam was. Most usually people thought of it as a kind of a idolatry of some kind, or maybe a pagan, ancient pagan religion. So they also had very little interest in what the Muslims actually believed. Their interest, the overriding Christian interest in that area, was to safeguard the holy sites so that pilgrims could go there safely and pray. So beyond that, they weren't very interested in the Muslim religion. Now, there were some cases of people who actually did take some interest in it and wrote some things about it, but that was very limited. About the only place you would find Christians and Muslims in the Middle Ages really getting to know their respective religions would be in Spain, but not in the Holy Land. It wasn't part of the discussion between the two.
What was the mindset of European leadership, in particular the papal leadership, and then people within the empire at the time, the waning empire? What was their mindset toward the military encroachment of Islam, or of the adherents to Islam, into their territories, into their cities? Not only what was happening down in the Middle East, but European encroachment.
Yeah. Well, they weren't happy about it, obviously. having a lot of Muslim warriors come and attack your lands and then take it over is generally not something that will make you happy. So they were upset about it. In the East, however, the Byzantine Empire, which was the Christian Empire in the East, largely had, although they were upset when it would happen, they had a kind of a mindset toward this, that once it had happened, they would just basically accept it. Some scholars have argued that the reason for this was that the Byzantine Empire really didn't have an understanding of an empire that was not completely Christian, one that had Muslims in it. And for that reason, once territories were overrun by Muslims, they had less interest in actually restoring those. The Christian West wasn't really much affected except in Spain. And there, really from the moment Spain is conquered, there is a relentless effort to try to reconquer these territories called the Reconquista, which would last for seven centuries of this constant campaigning to try to push back the Muslim conquest in Spain, which was ultimately successful.
You know, we've talked about this in context of the release of the movie Kingdom of Heaven. As an historian and as a student of the Crusades, do you think a movie could be made that would accurately, I mean, this is a big subject, but that could accurately tell the story of Crusaders within the context, an accurate context of the Crusades themselves?
You could. I think actually it would be a fairly exciting movie. You could tell a story. You could use the exact same period, the exact same characters, and the exact same time as was used for Kingdom of Heaven, but actually tell what we know about those people and their times. And I think it would be an entertaining, probably more entertaining than this movie, which comes off as flat. The speeches are all ponderous. It's very preachy in that respect. And you walk away wondering why any of the people in this movie are doing the things that they are doing. The movie, one of the last scenes in the movie is the defense of Jerusalem. And in this defense of Jerusalem, Balian, the protagonist, who's played by Alan Bloom, is getting ready to lead the defense, and he points out that Jerusalem doesn't matter, he says. It's the people that matter, and that he's come all this way to defend the people. And he talks about Jerusalem just as the stones that are completely irrelevant. That's the opposite view of the Middle Ages, that Jerusalem was viewed as a holy relic that was sanctified by the life and death and resurrection of Christ. The people were there to safeguard that relic. And Balian, it really makes you wonder, watching Balian, why did you come all the way to Jerusalem just to defend people? I mean, aren't there any people in France that you could have defended? It doesn't make any sense from a plot perspective. So actually injecting medieval piety into a movie would have made all of these events actually make sense. But that clearly was not the agenda of the movie makers.
Finally, there seems to be, and have always, it seems there always has been, two extremes on the issue of the Crusades. The one extreme, of course, would be to say that it was just a thoroughly ill-motivated, totally un-Christian effort, and that nothing about the Crusades could possibly, as a matter of history, recommend itself to us today. The other extreme, of course, then would be to romanticize the Crusades to the point where they are purified, or, as you used the term before in a different context, they're sanitized so that people can look back at them without any type of qualms of conscience. Where should the accurate student of history, where should an accurate picture between those two extremes fall on the Crusades?
Well, I think that the best way is to view them within their own context. The world then was very different than the world that exists today. And I think the only way that we can understand them properly is to understand the way the people there understood them. And we have to, at the beginning, recognize that their world is not our world, and their fights are not our fights. And so I think that's the best way to approach it. Nobody's calling a crusade today. But nevertheless, it's important for us to understand what were the events that led to the Crusades and how were they understood by the people that did them. Modern caricatures of that don't lead us anywhere, either on the positive or the negative side.
Dr. Thomas Madden is professor and chairman of the Department of History at St. Louis University and author of the book, The New Concise History of the Crusades. Dr. Madden, thank you very much for being our guest.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Tom.
When we come back from this break, well, we've got 25 minutes left in the program, and during those 25 minutes, somehow we're going to talk about moving from where we are in education to where we were. Now, this is going to go against the grain for some, because when it comes to education, we like to talk about things being progressive. But if one looks at a classical model of Christian education, one sees in the way that education, by and large, at least in the West, was done, perhaps the future of education today, and perhaps a brighter future for education than is being painted by the way we're teaching our children. We're going to talk about making the transition to classical education with Pastor Joel Brondos after this.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What's the relationship between sound doctrine and sound practice? Can the sound doctrine of the church survive if its practice is compromised? Can a church claim to have sound doctrine if it doesn't any longer have sound practice? The Fire and the Staff is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Clement Preuss. To find The Fire and the Staff, visit either of Concordia Publishing House's bookstores in the St. Louis area. One is in the city at 3558 South Jefferson, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. The book is $26.99 plus shipping and handling. When you go in, mention Issues Etc. and the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff by Pastor Clement Preuss. Or for more information on The Fire and the Staff, visit our website, issuesetc.org, and find the book on the homepage.
Destroy the family, and destroy a nation?
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a major creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, are you telling me that a nation can be destroyed by destroying its families?
Well, that's for sure. The Bible teaches us that the family is the first human institution God ordained. And Genesis gives a record of the first family, Adam and Eve. Now, the Bible tells us that one of the most important aspects of marriage is to have godly offspring. Fathers are to be the spiritual head of their homes, to communicate and model spiritual truths to their children. In fact, the family is God's instrument to pass knowledge of Him and His Word from one generation to the next. So Satan knows that one way to attack the Christian foundation in a country is to attack the family. Break up families and you've weakened the foundation of a nation. And you know, one of his methods is through the teaching of evolution. You see, if evolution's true, then the Genesis account of marriage and the family has no foundation. And if Genesis isn't true, children and adults will start doubting what the Bible says and start determining truth for themselves anyway. How do we prevent Satan from destroying families? We need to build a foundation on God's instructions as stated in Genesis, not on man's fallible opinions of evolution and other humanistic ideas.
The Bible is the true history book of the universe. That's the theme of one of Ken Ham's free booklets available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. Next time you're on the web, please go to AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. In 374 B.C., the Greek philosopher Plato wrote, quote, "Shall we just carelessly allow our children to hear tales which may be devised by casual persons and to receive into their minds ideas which are the very opposite of those we wish them to have?" End quote. Plato knew that stories are value-laden and influential. Our children are especially impressed and influenced by the stories they see in the media. What kind of stories are your children watching? What values do they see exemplified in their sitcoms, docudramas, and talk shows? Stories are influential, and there are no better stories for your children to know than those from the Bible, which tell of Jesus and His love. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at cmli.org.
May is going to be a great month to play the AME 50KFUO Daily Bible Quiz. Here's why. Every person who calls the station with a correct answer to the Bible quiz through May 26th will be included in a random drawing on Friday, May 27th for a special English Standard Version Bible autographed by our group of Bible study guest pastors. And the pastors are marking their favorite verses. May is going to be a great month to play the AME 50KFUO Daily Bible Quiz.
Welcome back to the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Pastor Joel Brandos joins us for the second of two conversations we're having on classical education. Now, you might not have heard the first one. We're going to talk a bit about classical education itself. But in this 25 minutes, making the transition from where we are now in education to where we were. This is not so much an issue of going forward as going backward to a model of education that probably suits the way human beings think, or at least ought to think, better. And it does a better job of doing what education ought to do. Educating, teaching, teaching for life. Pastor Joel Brandos is headmaster of Zion Lutheran Academy in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And he is headmaster-elect of St. Paul Lutheran Church and School in Brookfield, Illinois. St. Paul's Brookfield will be hosting a classical education conference June the 27th through July the 1st. Pastor Brandos, welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
Why should a school consider moving to a classical education model?
Well, I think Peter Paul Vergerius put it very well back in the beginning of the 15th century that what kind of an education does a free and democratic society need? Are we merely concerned about training people for jobs? We just want to teach them how to work and do like one job really well? Or do we want to think about other things as a free society, being able to teach people how to think and how to learn for themselves? And we also want to answer the question, what does it mean to be human? I mean, why are we doing all of these things? Is there a bigger goal for all of this? So I would say a classical education is not just another fad coming along to try to deal with some of the difficult low scores that we've heard about and seeing some of the Pacific Rim countries pass us by with some of those things. I think even though that's happening, a classical education is going to be of greater use than that. Again, if they're just learning technical skills, they're going to be missing out on what it really means to be human and how a free and democratic society educates its children.
Well, let's make sure, first off, that we all understand what we're talking about when we talk about making a transition to a classical education model. A lot of people, I think, just fundamentally misunderstand the whole move that is afoot in education. They think that going to a classical education model is about more rigorous rules, more homework, uniforms, maybe some Latin, and some more rules, and some more homework. And that's what they think classical education model amounts to.
Well, that would be a very stereotypical way of looking at things, and very unfortunate. Classical education really wants to fascinate children and adults, too. They all become learners, scholars. That's what students were called in years gone by, to consider their world around them, first of all, and looking at it in a very structured way. And so at the younger age, we don't think it's inappropriate to have them do some memorization, but to get the basic building blocks and facts that they're going to work with in the coming years. And then as they get a little bit older, they take a look at all of these facts that they've learned in an organized way and start putting it together to see how things relate to one another. And then finally, in the third stage, they want to be able to create based on some real foundational principles and having some good things, good building materials to work with.
We didn't mention this in our last conversation, but I think it does bear mentioning here that Lutherans in particular do have some roots in the classical education model. And I'm thinking about none other than one of the reformers, Luther's good friend, author of several significant books in the Lutheran Confessions, Philip Melanchthon, who I was surprised to discover when I went to Germany some time back, is known by Germans as the father of modern education, what we would consider now classical education.
Sure, the Preceptor Germaniae. He was the very big leader in the humanities. And if we take a look at the Saxon Visitation articles that he wrote, and we find the last part of that, it was not just talking about doctrine among the churches, but how the schools were to be organized for the good of society.
Now, one of the things that that Melanchthon introduced that I think has gone by the wayside in modern education is the emphasis on classical, and that is on the classics. You just mentioned genuine, true Christian humanism that Melanchthon advocated, with the phrase ad fontes, back to the sources. And by that, he meant scripture. He meant the classics of Western literature at the time. He meant the sources of knowledge that now have come down through all of civilization and history. Talk about that.
Well, sure. And Luther was very much along the same lines. Besides being interested in translating scripture, Luther was very much interested in translating Aesop's fables, not anything terribly highfalutin, but got the message across about how we take a look at virtue, for example. So besides Aesop, Luther and Melanchthon commended Cato, and the people that were reading at the time maybe were very much entrenched with some very detailed scholastic writings, and Luther said, no, that's not the thing to do. Some of these classic authors, what might have been Cicero, Cato, Aesop, these had some wonderful things, Luther said, in order to teach us about how we live toward one another.
How important is reading as a fundamental in the classical model of education? Nowadays, textbooks are unintelligible. I'm a father of a junior high daughter and a son who's 9 years old, and I can tell you that these things are unreadable. They're incoherent. They don't stay on one subject for even half a page. They're always jumping around, and they're so full of little illustrations and breaks in the text that one even wonders whether they read as one thought from one end to the other.
Well, right, there's so many aspects of that. I remember looking at a book in a library, which at one time, maybe 100 years ago, they were trying to discover what would be the best way of putting text into books for teaching children to read. And they developed a certain kind of font and whatever, and they purposely did not put illustrations in the book. I mean, they were very clear about that because they felt that those illustrations quite often distracted more than they helped. So I would say with regard to reading, too, just a fundamental idea that we're in classical education, we're not teaching reading as a skill per se, but we want to see reading as the communication of content, of wonderful ideas that engage children. And so in the work that we've done here at Zion, the children read really good literature that inspires them. It's not just a matter of reading some paragraphs that happen to have this week's vocabulary words in them, but they are fascinated by the storyline and drawn into the reading rather than just getting some kind of a skill of how to sound out words and put them together. But I'm with you, too. I think everything from chemistry books to math books could stand to have a little bit of literature flavored within there.
Well, I spoke sometime back at a classical education conference. I don't know why they asked me. I think you were there as well. I think we actually sat down and had lunch at this conference up in Wyoming, I believe. And I don't know why they asked me, because I started my talk by saying, look, I am anything but the product of a classical education. I'm the product of the opposite of a classical education, and that anything I know has really been remedial. I wonder how much remedial work needs to be done if we make a transition
to
classical education.
I think it was pretty apparent to everyone who heard you speak only the first 5 minutes to know very well why you were there, and people were very delighted with your presentation. I think that many of us who have started investigating and digging into this classical education, I've had this, seen this experience communicated to me by other people, that they get kind of angry, that they realize, I could have been learning all this stuff all along, and why didn't anybody teach it to me? So it's communicating some of this content, very fascinating. I think one good example of that today, just on the news last night, is David McCullough. When you listen to him talk about history, it's just fascinating. And some of us may wonder, why didn't we ever get anything like that?
Or when you read what he wrote, what he's written, suddenly you realize, wow, I didn't get any history education at all, not compared to the font of knowledge that this one man seems to have been able to unplug and pour forth.
Right.
Let's talk about teachers, parents, and children. What is absolutely necessary if a school is going to make a transition from education as it is to classical education when it comes to the teachers?
Sure. Well, there we should probably be aware of a few roadblocks with regard to making transition to classical education. First of all, there are some attitudes that classical education may sound rather intimidating to people, or it may sound elitist to them, only at first blush when they don't really understand what it's all about. I've seen teachers sometimes hear what classical education is and a couple occasions just break into tears thinking, I can never do that. But it's not that it's demanding on them, really, but we are asking them to be fascinated and to do some learning on their own. This isn't an experience just with classical education. Edie Hirsch has sort of gotten this core knowledge education going here in the United States and elsewhere. That's not exactly classical, but what it has in common with classical education is that it expects teachers to learn their subject matter well. And I remember seeing several different examples from the teachers who thought they were going to hate this core knowledge education because they would have to write their own lesson plans and they couldn't just rely on textbook anymore. But after many of them got into it, they were all the more fascinated by the subject matter because they were learning and asking questions about what the subject matter was and being able to communicate that in a story way. So sometimes the attitudes are difficult to overcome, but once they do, the teachers are very enthusiastic about doing that. So it's not somebody who has to have some kind of a formal training. It's helpful to have a liberal arts education, to be a teacher in a classical school, but I think what's more important is for a teacher to be willing to ask questions and find answers, to have a thirst and a hunger for knowledge and to seek out those things. I think we, whether it's boards of education or parents, need to help teachers a little bit because teaching can be a very difficult drudgery if it's just grading papers and doing lesson plans. But to help teachers have some time and to reward the occasions when teachers do go out there and start investigating things and don't rely just on textbooks.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on classical education, our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Joel Brondos is our guest. What about parents? Where are the challenges there in making a transition to classical education with the parents of our children?
Well, I think it's quite often much easier to fascinate parents, if you will, that they often see or sense, and maybe not even know exactly all the details, that something is lacking. And when they become aware of what this kind of education is, I've always had the experience of parents who are very much interested in having this for their children. And it also can help bring parents and children together. It's perhaps to some degree like, you know, children asking why the sky is blue and the parent and child having a discussion, an intelligent discussion about how that happens. And we just love to have and see parents engaging in that kind of a thing themselves.
Can it be intimidating to parents, a parent like me, coming from an education system where I think I was ill-served in terms of what I needed to learn and how I was expected to learn it, to say, okay, my kids are going to get a better education. I like that idea, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to keep up with them.
Sure, and it, you know, people talk about better education and not really know exactly what that is. However, I think there are some books, for example, that I've read. I never would have imagined myself reading a book on math, for example. I didn't find math terribly stimulating when I was going to school. But just reading a book like Michael Gillen's Five Equations That Changed the World, or some of Kendall Haven's books on math, to tell a story about mathematicians and how math came to be, it's very fascinating. And once you get hooked on something like that, that is fairly easy to read, you are drawn into wanting to learn more about numbers and see a fascination with numbers that you might never have seen before. And that reminds me of a point that I often like to make with teachers. A lot of teachers, and I've asked teachers if standing in front of a bunch of teachers where they could throw pens at me or whatever, but I said, it seems to me that the majority of teachers, at least coming from our Concordia universities, seem to emphasize literature and reading when they go through school. And there aren't a whole lot of teachers that have a specialty or emphasis in math and science. And most of them will agree to that. And so many of them feel less comfortable with topics like science and math or history. But if they're comfortable with literature, there are some great literary works, I mean, not great in the sense of classic pieces, but some wonderful reading that will draw them into math and science and history. And once they do that, I think they get the bug.
Let's go to the phones. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Gail calls from St. Charles. Gail, welcome.
Hi. This is such a great discussion. It's a subject close to my heart, and I thank you for airing this. And I don't mean this to be in a sound bad, but I think one of the things we could do in this area is maybe do something in our seminaries, because I do know that some of our young pastors are coming out with a completely almost different language than we grew up with, and it sounds it doesn't sound like they've been very well educated. And they're going to be teaching the youth. And, I mean, they're great on theology, but in just delivering sermons and things, it sounds like a little bit casual, a little bit something missing. And I wondered if your guest would comment on that.
Very interesting observation, Gail. Well, that's right up your alley, Joel. Take a whack at that one.
Well, that's a wonderful question, and I think it's a very good one that needs to be made, absolutely. When I went to the seminary back in the 80s, I had a class of pastor as educator with Dr. Wayne Schmidt, and yeah. I really enjoyed that class because it taught such basic things such as doing a lesson plan and how to convey information to students, and it was very good. I'm not sure if they're doing that at St. Louis anymore, but here I am up in Fort Wayne. I know that they don't have a class like that up here in Fort Wayne. And, you know, the basic office of a pastor is preaching and teaching. And one would think that they would have some very basic classes in teaching on how to do some of those basic things. And also a very important part, both for pastors and teachers, I think, is getting a little bit of a history of education. How has how has education been done over history? What are the good points and bad points? So, yes, I'd be all in favor of seeing that, and I've often sort of penciled in. I get asked to speak every once in a while at the seminary, and have had some wonderful experiences there. The students are very much interested in this kind of an education and would like to know more about it. And they, perhaps like me, end up getting as much, if not more, of an education after they finish the seminary. But it's just a matter of getting to know people, digging into some of these things as well, I think.
Well, what about, as Gail mentions, a man standing in the pulpit who, as she said, speaks a different language than we were taught to speak, not so much trying to accommodate himself to the young people of today, but perhaps betraying sloppy thinking, sloppy exposition, perhaps even sloppy articulation. I'm not talking about how they their diction, but I'm talking about the way they get ideas across. And the scripture says, apt to teach, a clear teacher above all else. What are your thoughts on that, Joel?
Well, one can't speak well if one can't think well. That is comprised of two different things. First of all, you have to have some decent data. You have to have something to say, some kind of content there. And then, secondly, you have to know how to communicate it. And we see this in classical education, perhaps, both in terms of logic and rhetoric. Again, the idea is not to just be persuasive, not to manipulate people. We see too much of that in sermons. But rather, you know, sermon preaching is primarily the proclamation of the gospel. But in the proclamation of the law, to drive that home, to expose sin, a pastor really needs, I mean, I can really tell a pastor who preaches who is well-read and one who isn't. Somebody who reads a wide variety of things, has a general education, and can relate to people on all of those subjects, rather than somebody who just does, you know, Greek and Hebrew or reads theology or something like that. Those things are very important too, but the practical aspect of being a pastor is brought to life through something like classical education. And that's why I'm not sure how true it is for a pastor studying today, but when I was going through school, the seminary and college training were more in a single line, and I got a liberal arts education before I went to the seminary. So I had emphasis on languages, an emphasis on humanities, and a general broad perspective of what it meant to be a person in the world.
We talked about teachers, we talked about parents. Of course, we must talk about the children as well. When making a transition to classical education, what should children be taught to expect? And how should this transition be portrayed to them? These are kids who may have, up to this point, been in the old model of education, and suddenly things are going to get very different very quickly.
Right.
About 2 minutes here.
Yeah, and I really hope I have some time, too, to talk about our conference as
yes.
well. But I do want to say that children, we have had children, for example, transfer into our school, not knowing whether or not they're going to make it or not, and what are they going to do. But what we often find is that children come, and when they get into our literature program, they're much more fascinated in reading than anything that they had before. They sense that there is something more substantive in the classes that are being taught, and that, in turn, fascinates them more, gets them more involved and willing to do homework because they don't see it just as being stupid, busy work, but they really are getting something out of it. And then, my goodness, the conversations that my wife talks about the kids having in third grade, I think just off the top of my head, they were going through some vocabulary, and we're talking something about a virtue. I can't remember which one right now. And one of the kids said, yeah, you want to be kind of like one world leader. And they said, yeah, and you don't want to be like Attila the Hun. And they started off on this fantastic conversation on the basis of a vocabulary word because they had some real data to work with.
In the last few minutes here, we've got about 2.5 minutes. Tell us about this classical education conference coming up this summer in Brookfield, Illinois, near Chicago.
Right. If people are really interested in making a transition, the very best thing to do is to get involved, get to know people, and to hear from their experiences, to learn from them. Don't do it all from scratch. And at this conference we're having up in Chicago, I just have some of the best people coming. Betty Garwood and Linda Snyder from out at Casper, Wyoming, Betty is just the dearest person, and she's been teaching for a long time and then made the transition herself to classical education. And she just instructs teachers and so very wonderfully. I have my own wife who's been teaching the classical education now for several years, and Kim Hughes, who's at Peter Bender's Catechetical Academy up in Sussex, Tisa Sussex, Erica Mildred, daughter of Robert Shibley, and we have Joel Baisley, who's did Luther's Family Devotions. He's going to be doing that session on that for us, along with Simple Machines and the history of Simple Machines, because before he was a pastor, Pastor Baisley taught science in our schools. So it's a wonderful camaraderie at these conferences. It's not just the impartation of some kind of information, but it's building a relationship and getting a real appreciation and fascination for things that people haven't had before. So I just want to say, for example, at our last conference last year, we had teachers come because they were told that they really needed to come. During the conference, they were up like till 2 or 3 in the morning talk about how they were going to implement these things, and just so very eager and excited to get back to school and start doing those things. So I just really can't, I'm not just beating my own drum. I'm not making any money off of this thing or trying to sell anything, but there's so many wonderful things that are available to people if they can spare a week or a couple days of their time this summer.
Now, is this Brookfield Classical Education Conference near Chicago just for teachers, principals, headmaster types?
It's for everybody. We have homeschoolers coming to our conferences. We have teachers and parents, Board of Education members, pastors, so all kinds of people who are interested in what's going on. It's a great mix of people.
Well, folks, I want to encourage you, because this is the kind of thing that I wish I would have had. A mom and a dad. Oh, I had a great mom and dad, and I had great teachers. I really did love them, and they were very well-meaning. They were operating with a model that hamstrung them as much as it hamstrung me. If I would have had a classical education, who knows? Who knows? I wouldn't be sitting here, not working with these bozos, that's for sure. So take the opportunity to go up to Brookfield near Chicago for a classical education conference, June the 27th through July the 1st. If you're a teacher, if you're a principal, if you're a parent, if you're a homeschooler, it's for you. For more information, the email address to write to classicaled@gmail.com, classicaled@gmail.com. It's a classical education conference, June the 27th through July the 1st at St. Paul's in Brookfield, Illinois, near Chicago. We'll be posting something on our website to be looking for that at issuesetc.org. Pastor Joel Brondos, thank you for being our guest.
Great as always. Thanks.
Pastor Joel Brondos, headmaster of Zion Lutheran Academy in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thank you for listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkins.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.